Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast, bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Greetings, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator, and tonight, we're introducing a new author to the show, Ambrose Ibsen. We've got 2 stories from Ambrose tonight, and I gotta tell you, I really dug both of these. In fact, I think that both of them are best experienced blind for maximum effect. Thusly, we will be skipping the story synopses this time around and jumping right into the meat of it, so to say. Still, I think the titles alone are titillating enough in themselves. On the Third Lap, and When the Spider in Your Lover's Mouth Has Gone. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Ambrose Ibsen, I give you On the Third Lap. When I faced the choice between a pedometer and a battery of new meds, I chose the pedometer. At the yearly checkup, my GP was more than a little peeved. Flipping through my paperwork, I found his every glance at my labs punctuated by a quirked brow or an exasperated sigh. "Those changes to your diet and lifestyle we discussed during your last appointment," he finally said, drumming a pen against his knee. "You didn't take any of those on board, did you?" It was true enough that my love affair with beer and pizza had only deepened since my last visit to the doctor's, and that my blood pressure and weight, already points of concern, had increased further. "It's been so hard," I complained. "You know how it is, trying to eat well at work, and these days I just can't seem to keep it off. At 25, 30, I could eat whatever I wanted, Doc. Now if I even look at the wrong foods, I wake up paunchier." "Would that we could all remain 25, came his stony quip. "We're approaching a crossroads, Len. This BP is getting out of hand, and your labs are all out of whack. Your liver panel alone is..." He tossed his shoulders. "We need to start thinking about meds." "I really don't like the sound of that," I admitted. "Isn't there some other way? I don't want to be on a cocktail of meds for the rest of my life, sucking down handfuls of pills. We discussed the other way, diet and exercise, during your last appointment. Well, what kind of meds are we talking about here? Oh, the way you're going, we're going to be starting on statins, something for that hypertension, maybe even something for that blood glucose of yours. I could formally declare you pre-diabetic with numbers like these. In the end, I got off with a serious scolding, but no new medications. And another thing, a firm promise that I'd employ the lifestyle changes he'd suggested consistently until our next meeting in 3 months. If my numbers were still poor by that forthcoming appointment, he promised to throw the whole pharmacology handbook at me. I found Rachel grinning in the passenger seat as I came sauntering out of the doctor's office that afternoon. She'd come along with me and was playing some noisy puzzle game on her phone until I approached the car and plopped down into the driver's seat. "You really laid into you, I see." She put on her seatbelt and pocketed her phone. "How bad?" "Plenty bad," said I. "He's threatening me with every pill under the sun if I don't shape up." "So, shape up," she replied. "Easy for you to say." My wife of 20 years, as trim as the day I'd met her, was nothing if not a salad enthusiast. Always active and dabbling with new diets, her middle name may as well have been Moderation. "You could live on grass and topsoil, dear." "With a zest of lemon, perhaps?" "Yeah, well, not me. I've got appetites. I've got hunger, you know. I like to eat. It's been that way since I can remember." "You need a hobby." "I've got hobbies. Hobbies that don't involve you sitting in front of a TV, babe." I wheeled out of the parking lot and started for the freeway, tapping at the wheel in exasperation. "He says I've got to start watching my diet and exercising. So what? No more burgers? No more IPAs?" "That's just for starters," she put in. "You're going to have to do a lot better than that if you want to get in shape." "You're all in league, aren't you? Just trying to ruin my life." "It really isn't that bad, dear. You can start small, believe it or not. Making one small change to your diet or daily activity, you'll be surprised at how easy it is. Then you roll that victory into another, and then another. That's how you build momentum. Before you know it, you're juice fasting and running marathons." "Sounds exhausting." "Well, it's true. And once you get into better shape, you'll have all kinds of energy. It only sounds tiring because you're carrying a bit of extra weight right now." I teased the edge of the rearview mirror, bringing the soft edge of my face into focus. "Listen to you now, talking about my spare tire. You know I'm vain, Rachel. You're going to give me a complex." She chuckled. "You've never exactly been James Dean, my love." "Nor you, Bridget Bardot." "We could try walking." Rachel yanked out her phone and went scrolling. "Walking is the fundamental movement, the stuff good health is built on, if you ask me. If you did nothing else in the way of exercise except for loads of walking, I think you'd be much better off than you are now. Surely walking isn't too much to ask." Walking seemed simple enough on its face. "How much mileage are we talking?" "I've seen a lot of numbers thrown around. 10,000, 15,000 steps. "You're losing me," I warned. "First you tell me and ice cream are through. Now you're putting numbers out there in the tens of thousands? I'll be stepping from dawn till dusk." "No, it's not as bad as it sounds. I'll tell you what, we'll do it together. We'll get pedometers. You know, there are some lovely models available these days that sync up to your phone. You wear it on your wrist all day, like a watch. It tracks your vital signs, your daily mileage. I hear they're a lot of fun."
"If that's your idea of fun, I have terrible news."
"We'll start small, Len. Walks around the apartment complex. It's quiet enough and the sidewalks are well maintained. It'll be nice and easy. What do you say, 30 minutes of brisk walking after dinner?"
30 minutes?
"More, if you feel up to it."
"Let's not get carried away." So it was that we became the proud owners of matching digital pedometers. Rachel placed the order right there in the car, and by the wonders of modern commerce, the things were tossed noisily onto our doorstep by the next morning. By dinner, we had them charging in the living room and had adjusted the rubbery wristbands to fit us both comfortably. Thus began our evening ritual of walking through the apartment complex. It was hardly as scenic as a national park, but the layout of our suburban apartment complex was pleasant and green enough to make for comfortable, if not particularly interesting, after-dinner walks. I made a good-faith effort 6 days out of 7 to mirror Rachel's eating habits. My dinners consisted of fish, greenery, and other things I'd regularly shunned over my past 45 years. As soon as the table was cleared and the dishes were done, we always did the same, assuming, of course, the weather was decent. She would step into her sandals and I would strap on my running shoes. With pedometers securely on our wrists, we'd set out from our unit for 3 quick laps around the complex. The 6 large buildings comprising our apartment complex were arranged in an almost circular fashion, with large green spaces and parking lots scattered in between. One of the green spaces had lately been repurposed into a minuscule dog park, where the pets of tenants loafed around and seeded the half-dead grass with droppings their owners were often too lax to pick up. From our unit on the outer east fringe, we could pass said dog park, walk past the small leasing office and maintenance shed, stroll past the pool and the other 5 apartment buildings, before encountering a small convenience store. Turning at the convenience store, we would find ourselves within a stone's throw of our front door. Initially, the 3 laps left me surprisingly fatigued. True, I hadn't done any major exercise in ages, but I was shocked at how tired I was after a half hour of mere walking. Rachel set the pace, and despite her shorter legs, her springiness made it difficult for me to keep up for the first week or two. Whether it was on account of my improved diet or the regularity of these walks, I can't altogether say, but after about 2 weeks of this regime, I finally found it in myself to match her speed without sucking wind. In those early sessions, we mostly kept to the sidewalks within the inner ring of the complex. Now and then, we'd walk the outer ring, slowing a bit as we cooed at the dogs on offer, or pausing to make small talk with the people at the leasing office, but we scarcely deviated from the sidewalks in those earliest instances. When I finally started getting my bearings, the two of us decided to mix things up a bit and would go walking throughout the nooks and crannies of the complex. The parking lots and sidewalks outside of other buildings became our stomping grounds, and with this increased steppage came insights into the lives of our neighbors. Though we'd lived in our apartment for some years, we had never, up to that point, paid much attention to the other buildings. Now we found great amusement in making regular tours. It was July by the time we started our irregular explorations through the complex, and a particularly hot one at that. I'm not much for hot and sticky weather, but sensing that my health was turning a corner, I grinned and bore it through the heat and kept on. Schlepping through the lots, we became accustomed to studying the rows of parked cars outside the buildings and would often remark on them. A dusty old hatchback with a battered rear bumper became a source of great amusement for us. Its tires were half flat, and over the course of many weeks, it never once moved from its spot beneath the sagging pine. Rachel and I spun all kinds of stories about the car, about its owners, about how it had gotten its signature dent on the back bumper. We even took bets about how long it would take the property managers to discover its disrepair and have it hauled away. At least 2 or 3 tenants in the complex had left Christmas lights tangled around their outer railings from the previous year, and a few had prematurely set up jack-o'-lanterns to bake in the sun of highest summer. Such flourishes were technically a violation of lease terms, but the tired folks working the rental office had bigger fish to fry and usually turned a blind eye. Ditto with the smoking. The campus was littered with no smoking signage, but this rule was routinely disregarded by renters and maintenance men alike. Our meanderings throughout the community often brought with them smells. The aroma of burning charcoal, of sizzling hot dogs and hamburgers, sometimes flooded the air like perfume and would incite in me terrible cravings. We observed a lot of animals, too. Birds, squirrels, stray cats, and interesting bugs. All the while, our pedometers would track the mileage. Some days, we only managed to walk for the planned 30 minutes, but on some occasions, when the climate was more tolerable, or when the two of us were really into it, we'd go for 40, even 50 minutes. I hate to admit it, but a month into our after-dinner walks, I started to enjoy them, even to look forward to them. The changes in diet were already paying off. My step was easier, my pants were fitting more comfortably, and I was no longer winded at the mere prospect of going for a walk. There was one evening in mid-August, though, where Rachel and I had a brief interruption to our regularly scheduled walk. A work meeting kept me an additional 3 hours, pushing back our usual dinner. We finished eating just as the sun was beginning to set, and I considered calling off the day's walk as a result. "It's getting kind of late, don't you think?" I whined. "We can go a little longer tomorrow, but I don't know if I want to wander around this place in the dark." "Why not?" asked Rachel, stepping into her sandals. "It might be fun. We hardly ever see the complex by night." "I don't know. There might be more bugs. Mosquitoes. I hate mosquitoes." "You know, as your fitness improves, you're going to need more activity than this. If you're going to be so prissy, then maybe we should find some money for a gym membership. We can run on treadmills in an air-conditioned space. How's that sound? There are places around here with decent rates. I bet we could afford it." "I like the sound of air conditioning," I replied. "But who said anything about running?" "Let's just get out and do the walk. You'll be glad we did." Less than convinced, I put on my shoes and joined her by the door. Maybe a short one then, just long enough to help me digest." "Whatever you say." We set out into the young night, and we wound up walking for close to an hour. The complex proved serenely quiet, and the lack of surrounding traffic introduced a feeling of great peace. What's more, with the sun down, the temperature had dropped a few degrees, making for more comfortable conditions than in days previous. Hand in hand, we took our time and went looping around the place while watching the moon rise in the sky. I rather enjoyed myself, and I know that Rachel had a nice time too. That is, until we crossed into one of the dim parking lots, the one stationed between the third and fourth buildings in our usual sequence. In our apartment complex, there are no streetlights in the parking lots. Rather, the buildings themselves are all mounted with bright exterior lights, the glow of which seeps into the lots, sidewalks, and main drag. They draw a lot of insects at night, and are so bright, in fact, that we had to install blackout curtains in our bedroom in order to ensure decent sleep. The light produced by these staggered fixtures renders the apartments themselves in sharp relief, even in the wee small hours, but leaves many spaces between the buildings mired in hazy shadow. Striding through the lot, buried in thoughts about the work meeting I'd had just hours prior, I didn't immediately notice when Rachel stopped. It was only when I'd advanced several paces ahead and her steps had completely died out in the night's silent landscape that I also came to a halt and turned around. "What's up?" I asked. Grinning, I gave the pedometer on my wrist a little shake. "Need a break already?" Rachel wasn't looking at me, though. She'd paused on the sidewalk and was staring at a small sedan parked in a visitor's spot. In fact, she wasn't just staring. She appeared utterly entranced. "What's the matter?" I asked, backtracking just a bit. Following her gaze, I gave the car a once-over myself, and that's when I noticed what had so fiercely gripped her attention. Oh man, that's foul. The front end of the car was covered in what appeared to be massive flies. Brown, red-eyed bugs the size of nickels with large transparent wings were heaped upon the hood, windshield, and roof. There must have been a few dozen of the things, and I knew at a glance that they were no mere houseflies. These things were big and nasty, the kind of flies with a genuine bite. "You don't see that every day," muttered my wife with a shudder. "What in the world are those, Len?" I gulped, taking a step back. The flies scarcely moved. They weren't buzzing around the car, weren't crawling about it in insectival exploration. They were all just sitting there, heaped on the auto glass, on the wipers and side mirrors, as though awaiting a lift. "No clue," I said. "They look nasty, though. Maybe I'll look them up later. Big brown flies with red eyes." Rachel looked at the other cars nearby, to a pickup at the right and to an SUV at the left. "The flies are only on this car," she noted with a frown. Gesticulating to its neighbors, she added, "There are none on the truck or the SUV. They're all just gathered here. Don't you think that's strange?" I nodded, eager to put as much space between myself and the flies as possible. "It's definitely strange, yeah. And if I'm honest, I'm not too keen on hanging out with them." Rachel finally pulled away and raced past me on the sidewalk, hands in her pockets.
That's so gross. What could cause so many flies to just cling to a car like that? It's disgusting.
I chuckled, panning about the apartment building and shrugging. Who knows? There's something about that car they like, I guess. Maybe there's a bad smell about the car they're drawn to. Could be that the owner stepped in a turd at the dog park before his last drive and the flies are investigating. She nodded.
Could be. Or maybe he hit a bit of roadkill or something on his way home.
She kept on nodding, this theory taking root in her mind.
Maybe some bits of a dead animal are stuck to the tires or undercarriage.
Sure, I said, quickening my pace. Then, tapping at my pedometer to gauge our progress, I smirked and added, or, you know, there could be a body stashed in the trunk. Rachel stopped dead in her tracks. We'd built a good bit of distance between ourselves and the sedan in question, but she turned and glanced over her shoulder as though she expected to find it creeping up on us.
You really think so?
Don't be ridiculous, I replied. Dude just needs a car wash or something. Still, my wife didn't seem so easily convinced. She studied the vehicle in question for several seconds, even backtracked a few paces, before joining me with a defiant shake of her head.
Something about it really creeps me out, she ultimately said. I've never seen anything like that. Have you?
Not really, no. But so what?
It's gross, she protested.
No argument from me.
It's unnatural.
Strictly speaking, it's perfectly natural. This is the great outdoors, after all. If a bunch of bugs want to hang out on a car, then who are we to tell them no? We rounded the next corner and broke away from the strip of parked cars. But still, the ordinarily jovial mood of our walks had been somewhat spoiled. I tried making a little small talk about my work meeting, complained about my boss's rantings, but Rachel only half listened as we stomped along. Her thoughts were elsewhere, and every time she peeked over her shoulder with a narrow gaze and a hard frown, I knew just where her mind was. It was around the time we came upon the communal dumpsters that she halted once again. The pair of receptacles, large, squarish, and heavily rusted, had been packed to the heavens with all manner of trash. Someone had probably been evicted not too long ago, and their apartment thoroughly renovated by the property managers. At least, that was my assumption. Aside from a good deal of furniture, there were empty paint cans, rolls of old carpeting, and several tarps stuffed into the two dumpsters.
"What's your over-under on a recent eviction?" I posed, whistling as the gated dumpsters entered into view. It must have left quite a mess if the property managers had to tear out the carpet and such.
Rachel nibbled on her lower lip and approached the teeming bins with altogether more interest than she'd ever shown in garbage before.
Either that or someone was killed in one of those apartments, Len. It could be that the killer tore up the carpet, disposed of bloodied furniture, and painted the walls.
She shot me a little glance in the corner of her eye, and I admit I couldn't tell whether she was trying to pull my leg.
You know what I love most about you?
The way I look in yoga pants?
Yes, I replied. Your imagination is definitely a runner-up, though, in the top five, at least.
She folded her arms and then pivoted purposefully toward the rolled-up carpets. With gusto, she reached up and tugged at the stuff, presumably looking for stains.
Whoa, listen, knock that off, I said. There's no telling what's living in that carpet. If you bring home fleas or bedbugs, I'm going to make you sleep on the porch.
Come on, Len. Don't you see the connection? She clicked her tongue and moved briskly from the dumpsters, continuing our pre-planned circuit across the blacktop.
I think you've spun a story in your head and you're determined to see things your way, said I.
You're jumpy, out of your element. This is why we shouldn't go for these walks after dark.
Whatever.
We trudged on in near silence for the next half mile, I toying with my pedometer and happily watching the step count rise, and my wife panning the other sidewalks for either looming figures or dogs to pet, but finding neither. We passed a handful of open windows along first floor units, listened to families cleaning up after dinner, to people watching television or singing along to music. By day, when the lots were mostly empty and the occupants of these apartments were at school or work, it was easy to write the whole place off as a vacant shell, a facade. Now, passing through it silently under cover of night, we were reminded of the fact that we were always surrounded by others, the joys, sufferings, yearnings, and idiosyncrasies of other human beings were always but a door or window away, even if we sometimes fail to remember that fact. I couldn't keep my mind from wandering as we walked, and I got to wondering, as we took in one scene after another, whether anyone had ever died in one of these apartments. As far as I knew, the complex had been around for a few decades, built in the late 80s or early 90s. In that time, there'd probably been countless accidents across the property. Falls, cuts, burns, and medical emergencies of every shape and kind had almost certainly visited the complex since its founding. But what about a murder? Had anyone ever been killed in one of these apartments? By the time this question rose up in my mind, we were well into our second lap, and it came as something of a surprise to us that we were drawing near, once more, to the fly-covered sedan that had so disgusted us. It was Rachel who first noticed it again, encountering it with a terrible gasp as though it had come up and elbowed her in the gut. "Ugh," she spat. "There it is again." I paused before the car and looked it over from end to end. Perhaps it was only my imagination, in fact, it had to be my imagination, but it seemed as though none of the flies had moved an inch since my last study some 20-odd minutes ago. They were living things. Their little hands moved in that grotesque scheming motion so typical of their kind, and their wings sometimes fluttered as they shifted their weight. A few seemed to leap up now and then, catching the breeze, only to sail back down and settle on the hood with a buzz and a thump. I got as close to the thing as I could stand and squinted at the exterior. "Is there something on it? Maybe something got spilled on the car," I ventured. "You know, something sweet, something that would attract insects. Soda, perhaps." Rachel left the sidewalk altogether and began studying the vehicle from every side. She made a rather obvious show of peering into its side and back windows, and when she arrived at the car's rear, she had a truly miserable look on her face. "Get a load of this," she said, jabbing a finger toward the back seat. It was dark out, but the exterior building lights allowed one to look into cars parked along this front strip. I squinted through the tinted glass, but not before casting a nervous look at the three-story building in front of us. The last thing I wanted was to get chewed out by someone for suspiciously poking around their car. "What is it?" I asked. "The back seat's full," explained Rachel. I saw that it was indeed. The entire back seat was lined with what appeared to be large coolers, the kind one might haul to the beach to keep drinks cold. Curiously, their white plastic lids were covered in strips of duct tape, keeping them tightly shut. "Coolers, huh? That tape certainly won't make it easy to fish out a cold brewski, huh?" "They've been taped shut because they aren't supposed to be opened again. They're probably going to get dumped off somewhere, or buried," posited Rachel. I practically cackled at the insinuation. "What, you think a hacked-up body's been stored in him? Is that it?" Rachel pointed back toward the front end. "That's not all. There's like 20 air fresheners hanging from the rearview mirror. Look." I did as I was told, and if anything, found Rachel's estimate too conservative. There were indeed loads of tree-shaped air fresheners tied to the rearview mirror, as well as what looked to be odor-absorbing packets scattered across the dash. "So the guy likes his ride to smell fresh," I quipped. "Is that a crime?" "Len!" My wife looked ready to sock me in the gut. "Something's wrong here. You know I'm right." "Hey, it's definitely weird. I'm not arguing. I'm just saying, you can't assume something this heinous without really good proof." I looked again to the apartment building, half expecting someone to come charging out of the lower story door. "For all we know, the guy's a hunter, right? Those coolers could be full of fish or venison or something." With complete disregard, Rachel walked up to one of the back windows and all but pressed her face to the glass. Then, pulling away, she shook her head furiously. "Oh, no, no, no. No, Len, look! Look, there's blood! There's definitely blood on one of those cooler lids. It's a handprint, red and messy. Just look for yourself." "You're going to get us screamed at," I muttered. "This isn't our car and it isn't our business. Someone's going to come bounding out of one of these apartments any second."
I sidled up to the car and played at looking through the window. I don't know, babe. I don't really see it. There, right there on the lid, the one closest to the window, see? Sure enough, with a bit of effort, I spied what appeared to be a large, rusty splotch on the lid of molded plastic. It was vaguely hand-shaped, but far more interesting to me was its apparent freshness. The splotch didn't look dry. What the? See? See? I told you! It looks like it's still wet, I mumbled. That's weird. This is too much. We've got to call the cops, she said. Come on, let's call 911. That was a bridge too far for me, though. And tell them what? Some guy's got a bunch of flies on his car and a few large coolers in his back seat? He could have left that stuff in there after a cookout for all we know, babe. But what about the blood? He threw a steak on the grill with his bare hands and got some on the lid when he went to close it, I guessed. And what about the stuff in the dumpsters? The rolled up carpets? The furniture? People get evicted every day. I bet there's stuff like that in all the dumpsters around here. Not that I'd care to look. And the flies are just hanging out, enjoying the vibe, I reasoned. Wow. Look, what do you want me to do about it, babe? Want me to interrogate the flies? Ask them what they've been up to? What the fuss is all about? Wow. You're so above it all, Len. I'm just trying to be reasonable, I shot back. Sorry that I don't buy this whole murder mystery thing, okay? You're just going to ignore the... I threw my hands up. You want to call the cops over this? Be my guest. Call it in if you want. We'll all have a good laugh about it someday. But they're not going to do anything because there's no evidence of wrongdoing. Trust me, babe, this is no big deal. It's all a little weird, but that's not a crime. Can we please just finish this walk? Rachel didn't take this request of mine particularly well. In fact, it blew up in my face. You want to finish your walk? She echoed. Well, go right ahead. I'll see you at home. Irritated, she pulled away at once, muttering as she sped off toward our place. I called after her, tried to plead my case, but she wouldn't have it. She quickened her step, vanished around the bend, and I knew then that I'd be spending the night on the sofa in stony silence. The sound of her sneakers drumming against the sidewalk faded from hearing, and I was left with only flies for company. With a sigh, I continued my daily walk, less a march now than a stooping trudge. I was filled with all kinds of conflicting feelings as I moseyed on. On the one hand, I didn't feel as though I'd done anything wrong. Her insistence that something illicit had taken place had been silly. There was no proof of any crime here, nor any strong reason to suspect one. Just a few oddities. I felt that she'd flown off the handle, had built a mountain out of a molehill. Trouble was, Rachel had never been one to do that. I'd always known her to be pretty level-headed and usually trusted her instincts on things. If something about this car situation was putting her on edge, then perhaps there really was something to it, and I'd been wrong to shut her down the way I had. Subconsciously, I found my way back onto our usual track and completed the second lap, passing our front door and finding the lights on in our unit. At least she made it back safely, I thought. Briefly, I considered calling it a night and heading up to make amends. Knowing Rachel, though, I knew it better to give her a little space, and so I kept on past our building and entered into a third lap. This wasn't about health and fitness anymore. My continuing along the track was a strictly penitential affair now, and I shuffled along the sidewalk with my hands tucked into my pockets. Without my wife by my side, I no longer found the walk enjoyable. Where the two of us had spent the previous months building up a consistent fitness habit, the greatest joy I'd reaped from the arrangement had come from spending time with her. Our banter, the closeness we'd shared, without these, the walk felt hollow and rote. While it was true that I was feeling better than I had in some time thanks to the increased activity, I hardly felt the motivation to continue without her presence. I passed the dog park, where a woman tried coaxing a miniature pincher through the gate on a short leash. I sauntered past balconies, where smokers reclined and the occasional radio chirped, and from this or that open window such varied smells as Indian food, marinara, and cheap beer seeped out into the open. None of it interested me. The sounds, sights, and smells were nothing but a nuisance to my brooding. It was quite without expecting it that I found myself coming up to the fly-covered sedan during my solitary third lap. I happened upon the thing with suddenness, and I admit I was startled a little at the sight of it. There was nothing untoward about the thing, aside from the fact it was crawling with the gnarliest flies I'd ever seen in my life, but I recoiled from it all the same. Pausing on the sidewalk a few paces from its front fender, I scowled at it, as if to say, "You know, until you came along, I was having a perfectly lovely evening with my wife." That was when I heard it. The low, muffled, metallic thump. That it had come from nearby was plain. I watched as the flies on the hood of the sedan quivered in the wake of the sound, their wings stirred to life by the resultant vibrations coursing through the vehicle. It had come only once, a single blow, at once feeble and attention-grabbing, and I admit I swooned when I heard it. I peered past the buggy windshield and scoped out the interior, but failed, at first, to make out the source of the faint bang. Leaving the sidewalk and wedging myself between the sedan and neighboring SUV, I glanced furtively through the back windows, finding only the succession of taped-up coolers from before. The front seats remained unoccupied, and there were no signs that anyone had accessed the vehicle since my previous lap. But something was evidently stirring within. There was another bump, this one louder than the first, and I heard it most clearly as I shimmied up to the car's rear bumper. With a tremor in my breast, I dared to reach out and touch the top of the trunk. To my horror, the auto body was still quivering, and through the shell I could sense minute movements, as of a weight being groggily shifted. Something was in the trunk. It moved slowly, sporadically, as if only tenuously conscious. And more than this, as I stood by, aghast, it spoke.
"Please, please."
Unsteady whisperings poured from the trunk as the occupant suddenly tossed his weight to one side. Male or female, I couldn't say. The voice was too low, too breathy and pained.
"Please, there isn't much time. Please come closer."
"Yes?" I dared, in a tone hardly more formidable than the trunk dweller's. Are you hurt? In danger?" Such questions were admittedly ridiculous to ask under the circumstances, but having never encountered such a thing, I hardly knew what to say. "I hear you." A terrible groan issued from the trunk. The imprisoned one fought to orient himself, to sit upright perhaps, and sent the whole sedan rocking on its suspension. Flies scurried up onto the car roof, and their buzzing momentarily eclipsed everything else from hearing.
"Please,"
continued the pleading.
"There isn't much time. Come closer. I must tell you something."
"Yes, of course," I whispered back. Slowly, keeping my eyes pinned on the apartment building, I knelt down and very nearly pressed my ear against the top of the trunk. "What is it? I'm here for you. I'm listening." I heard a slow inhalation through the thin barrier of plastic and metal. And then, unexpectedly, a laugh. A slow, dry, and sinister laugh.
"You were right."
Shouldering equal parts bafflement and unease, I shook my head. "I'm sorry?" I drew away from the trunk a little, my breath fogging up the finish. "What do you mean?"
"You were absolutely right on that first lap."
I don't understand." The laugh rumbled through the shadowed confines, terminating in a higher register. Almost tittering, the one in the trunk elaborated.
"You told the woman there was a body in the trunk." "I heard you." "And you were right. There is a body in this trunk. And in the back seat, too. And under the seats."
The laughter reached an almost childish fever pitch. I swallowed hard and lost my balance, sitting on the asphalt while the flies crescendoed overhead. The truck was pummeled from the inside by a wild fist. "Let us out, will you?" This was obviously a disgusting joke of some kind. The vehicle owner was simply trying to get back at me and Rachel for our nosiness, and had crawled into his trunk in the interest of giving us a big scare. And it was certainly working. "All right, that's enough," I said, gaining my feet. "I'm sorry for being nosy. I didn't mean any harm." The inside of the trunk was treated to a 1-2 punch, which left the inner panels groaning. "Let us out!" I backed away, appealing to the neighborhood cars and buildings for aid. The lot was quiet and empty, however, and most of the apartments along the stretch sat dark and still. "Let us out! Let us out!" The only piece of technology I had on me was the wrist-worn pedometer, and as I staggered away from the sedan, its display lit up with a cheery alert, informing me that my heart rate was elevated. I was in the habit of leaving my phone at home during these walks in order to stave off the temptation of scrolling, and so would have to make it back to the apartment before I could dial 911. I rushed off, jerking in terror with every thump at the trunk lid, but did not feel truly threatened until, several paces on, I heard the thing spring open with a terrific squeal. I turned in time to watch the trunk fly open. The smell hit me before anything registered visually, a stomach-churning stench with joined notes of rot and artificial sweetness poured out across the lot. It was the smell of warmth-goaded decay holding hands with the cloying aroma of a gas station air freshener. The night was blackened by a surge of coin-sized flies. The beat of their wings as they fled the confines of the trunk could have blotted out a siren in the distance, and the things fanned out in a nauseous wave across the lot, perching on the sidewalk, on adjacent cars, on the blacktop, and on their quivering fellows themselves, till every surface within a dozen feet of the sedan seemed to wear a living carpet of the things. But this was not the only thing that emerged from the trunk. A thin figure clutched at the edges of the rear bumper and came shambling out, one leg at a time. Feet met the asphalt with the squelch of sticky blood, and the whole of the figure, evidently doused in gore, acted as human flypaper. Scores of the brown flies clung to him. Whether the thing that began limping after me was more man or fly, I couldn't even begin to say. I was less sure that he even existed. I felt myself in the grip of a mind-numbing hallucination, a waking nightmare. For the first time in years, I ran. Feet firmly on the ground, I put my sneakers to the test and bolted across the lot. Concepts like fatigue and fitness meant nothing to me as I broke into a full-on sprint. All I knew was survival. I rushed headlong into one of the green fields between apartments and, when I'd broken across the main drag, centered the glowing lights of the nearby convenience store in my sights. Following said lights like a beacon, I threw myself forward at full tilt till I could no longer hear the sticky, clopping tread behind me, nor the low and constant hum of angry flies. I all but collapsed on the stoop of our building. Pausing just long enough to ensure I wasn't still being trailed, I stole in through the lobby door and pulled myself up the stairs till I arrived shuddering at our unit. I pounded at the apartment door for all I was worth, realizing with a string of curses that I'd also left my keys, and kept my gaze fixed on the lower lobby, waiting for the shambling, fly-covered thing to enter the building. Mercifully, it never did, and Rachel, summoned by my maniac pounding, was quick to answer the door.
"Len, what's gotten into you?" she asked.
I pushed past her and slammed the door shut behind me, only then realizing just how out of breath I was. My hair was matted to my brow with sweat, and I could hardly drink in enough air to form words. I bolted the door and staggered a little ways into our living room, where I slowly approached our street-facing window. Tugging the blinds aside, I scoped out the sidewalks below, looking for the hideous thing that had come loping out of the sedan. Not so much as a fly entered into view. The night was peaceful, with traffic remaining sparse and nothing in the way of passerby.
"Len, what's the matter? What's wrong?"
Rachel gripped my soggy shoulders and gave me a hard shake.
"You're so pale. Are you feeling all right? Do I need to call an ambulance?"
Confident now that I'd escaped the thing, I pulled away from her and collapsed into my easy chair, head in my hands. There, I waved her off and insisted that I did not, in fact, need an ambulance. "I'm fine," I told her repeatedly. "Nothing's wrong. Nothing's wrong." She didn't believe me, of course. Settling on the sofa beside me, she held my trembling hand and swept the sweaty locks out of my eyes.
"Len, honey, what happened out there? What's wrong? Did something happen?"
When my heart had finally stopped jackhammering in my breast, I summoned a deep breath and spoke up. "You were right, Rachel. You were right." She arched a brow and shook her head.
"I was right. What do you mean?"
Glancing toward the window, I knew she was thinking back to the sedan, to the flies, to the little spat we'd had.
"Is this about..."
I couldn't burden my wife with what I'd seen. Rachel had been right. Something had been wrong with that car. There had been something in it. But rather than admitting this and getting her more deeply involved, I chose to shield her from the truth.
"You were right," I ultimately said. "These walks aren't doing it for me anymore, babe. I need more than just walking. We should join a gym and start running together, just like you suggested."
I didn't sleep a wink that night and wound up having to take the next day off of work. I was up late enough to hear the garbage trucks trundle by in the wee small hours, and when next I dared a short walk around the complex, I found each and every dumpster empty. The sedan parked in the visitor spot, the one that had been covered in flies, was also gone. It had been moved at some point in the night, and as I paced the grounds, I couldn't find so much as a single dead fly in the area. I did, however, happen to run into one of the maintenance workers as I strolled by. Mac, a handyman who'd been at the complex some years, shook his head at me as he sat upon the hood of his truck and smoked an afternoon cig.
"Some of these people, I tell you."
"What happened?" I asked. "Another backed up sink? Someone put too much pasta down the garbage disposal?"
"No," he said with a laugh. "Some idiot,"
he explained, pointing at the building ahead of us,
"moved out the other day, but he tore up all the carpeting before he left."
"This building here?" I asked. Mac nodded.
"Tore up every scrap of carpet in the living room, left the subfloor exposed. He painted the walls, too, but not in the right color. We're gonna have to repaint them now. I don't know what he was thinking, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was using his apartment as a drug lab or something. You know how people are, getting up to no good. Anyhow, it's a big headache. I'm gonna be stuck in there all day cleaning up after him. I hope the manager takes him to court for damages, though I rather doubt he will. The owners of the complex are spread so thin they'd rather crack the whip and have guys like me mop up the mess."
"I see." The building Mac had pointed to was, of course, the very one the sedan had been parked outside of the previous night. Whether the horror I'd encountered and the damage to the apartment in question were related was, technically, an open question. It was possible that the two events were unrelated, that Mac's contention was correct, and that the hideous run-in I'd had with the thing in the trunk had had nothing to do with the goings-on within the stripped apartment unit. Whatever the case, I never did go for a walk in the complex again after dark, and something like a year later, when I was offered a decent promotion, Rachel and I moved far away from the place, settling in a quiet neighborhood in a different zip code. You've been listening to On the Third Lap by Ambrose Ibsen. Next, here's When the Spider in Your Lover's Mouth Has Gone, also by Ambrose Ibsen. The setting sun burned behind the clouds like a bulb in need of changing, and a harsh wind stalked the foothills. I slotted the car into the driest patch I could find, a cubby perpendicular to the drive, hooded by the sodden boughs of a few overgrown tamaracks. The rain-haunted air, thick as syrup, didn't go down too easy. I drank it in between gritted teeth while surveying the area. The hills roundabout were shedding streams of runoff, and I could hear the gush of an overfed gully from nearby. Left to right, north to south, I took a good long look till I was sure we were alone. There was no one for miles but me and Marlene. Black-haired, chestnut-eyed Marlene. Marlene with the funny laugh. Marlene with the freckles and mischievous smile. Marlene, who slept peacefully beyond the waters of the tarn. There was nothing to do but begin the slow trek to the water's edge, but even so, I staved off the inevitable with glances at the little house couched in the western declivity. Its windows were dark and foggy like a doll's eyes. Already, she was half buried in weeds, and given a few seasons more, I wagered the growth might well overtake her crooked gutters and erase every outward trace of the life we used to live there. That suited me just fine. I could remember when those windows weren't half so dark or foggy. I could remember when they were left open in fair weather, and when her voice would pour out of them in song while she worked in the kitchen. I could remember it like it was yesterday. But now, I'd had my fill of remembering. A slow march brought me up and then down the slope. My boots cut squelching arcs into the mud, and my jeans and t-shirt were quickly pasted to me by the driving spray. I strove like a pilgrim toward the waterfront, and over the mossy hump, ringed in weathered boulders, I found the little pond, engorged and juddering thanks to the heavy rain. In way of preparation, I had brought with me only a single item, a waterproof LED. This I fished out of my back pocket and activated before stepping past the boulders and wading into the cold water. It was time for our reunion. They used to call us many things. Wackos, freaks, creeps, cultists. Marlene and I had heard it all, and from an outsider's point of view, the two of us could scarcely disagree with such labels. Our lifestyle, our beliefs, had been quite outside the norm. Forming the sect of the Veiled Sentinel cost us nearly everything. We were abandoned by our families, friends stopped returning our calls, and our community offered only cruel gossip and moral outrage. With all of our ties forcibly severed, we found ourselves with little choice but to flee into the outskirts. There, at least, we could have peace. It all began in my apartment one night. The two of us, lovers for some months, had been experimenting with ever-increasing dosages of hallucinogens and nootropic compounds. Up to that point, our escapades had resulted in terrific hallucinations, splitting headaches, and a shared gut feeling that we were butting against the very seams of reality. But on that fateful night, we went further, deeper than ever before. Marlene, in particular, walked straight off the edge and plummeted to some other place. Where she went is hard to say. Harder still is comprehending how she ever made it back. After megadosing exotic drugs, we entered a coma-like sleep of nearly 2 days. I emerged from this state dehydrated and viciously ill, and for some time after continued to battle horrific visions. Marlene, however, didn't emerge. She died. I first noticed it in the hours after coming to. Following bouts of vomiting, I had tried to rouse her, only to find her stiff and silent. Her skin had taken on a bluish tinge, and her eyes, open all the while, had become unbelievably dilated. She didn't respond to offers of water or food, and as the hours passed and I began to fear for her life, I tried other methods of awakening her. A rough sternal rub produced no reaction, neither did a series of hard pinches. Only then, still half-stoned, did I even think to look for a pulse or listen to her heart. And in my horror, I found her as still internally as she was externally. I fled the apartment in a haze of paranoia, chased by phantoms, real or imagined, I still can't say, and walked the streets till dawn came calling. When the wee small hours had passed and Mr. Sun had guided me out of the worst of my comedown, I slunk back home and wondered if Marlene's death had simply been another ghastly hallucination. Stealing in quietly, tentatively, I found my lover was no longer splayed out on the futon as she had been hours prior. Instead, she was now seated upon the floor, cross-legged. The color had come back to her skin. In fact, it had more than returned, and her flesh now glowed in dewy hues of healthful radiance. Curiously, she was blindfolded with a strip of white cloth that had been torn from a bedsheet. Like Lady Justice, she turned majestically and beheld me from behind the veil. No longer was she under the influence of any drug, and no longer did she wear the fetters of human limitation. Having passed between the realms of the living and the dead, the old ways had been obliterated in her, and she had been filled, as a vessel is filled, with the pure waters of some other sphere. When she spoke to me, it was not in a voice I recognized, and when she shared with me the fruits of her travels, my very soul was stirred by the authority of her instruction. The one I had known and loved as Marlene had been effaced to make room for something new from beyond the ether. Gone were the days of drugs and experimentation. Here, in the space of some few worldly hours, she had gleaned from these tools all that could be gleaned, and she now carried the fullness of this knowledge within her. The human form in which this all-encompassing intelligence now resided was altogether inadequate. Marlene was but a holding tank. A new vessel, a new mode of being, was apparently a great necessity, and once so equipped, the visitor from beyond, I was taught, would be able to lead the world into a new, enlightened age. But before that new age could dawn, the bondage of the old would have to be stripped away. There were others who once shared our vision. Marlene and I invited friends and acquaintances of ours, largely those with a background in drug culture, to live with us and learn. These came and went, most unwilling to give what was demanded of them. Word got out about Marlene's teachings, of her claims to otherworldly powers and insights, and it was then that the mockery began. They were intensified in the weeks and months to come as a few acolytes, myself included, grew more fervent in our servitude. At her instruction, I made myself a eunuch as the high priests of old and led the others in candlelit forays into the stuff of fathomless eons. Rituals of cleansing, some of which involved mortification and injury of our physical selves, made no small waves in the local community. By this time, the lot of us were already estranged from family and close friends, but the sniffing around of police, journalists, and others made it necessary for us to seek seclusion. Through the pooling of funds, we purchased a small house on a remote property. There, we intended to practice our faith in secrecy, and to bring the other to complete fruition. Marlene and I, along with three other men, moved into the house. By the next autumn, however, only Marlene and I remained. Life in the small house was strange by any conventional measure. Marlene was left to live in the larger of the house's two bedrooms alone, while the four of us acolytes made use of the other rooms. The four of us tended to the needs of the property, and Marlene, when the pull of the otherworldly was lessened, would sometimes join us for walks and meals. None of us were allowed to enter Marlene's sanctum. Only when summoned were we to step into the rearmost bedroom. This precaution was intended as a protection for us, for there were aspects of Marlene's transformation which were frankly dangerous. In those moments when her humanity ebbed and the other waxed most profoundly within her, it was dangerous to gaze into Marlene's open eyes. A steward of hidden things, She could communicate in a single gaze maddening truths that the psyches of mortal men could not withstand. It was for this reason that she wore the blindfold. Early on, one of the initiates, spurred by intense curiosity, ventured into Marlene's room late at night, seeking an audience with her while the rest of us slept. He emerged shortly thereafter, a gibbering mess, and proceeded to flee the property. We learned not long after that he had perished by his own hand, had thrown himself off an overpass. This incident only added to the slanders and cruel speculations about our sect, and when the linkage was made between us and the suicide, we were questioned thoroughly by the local authorities. In the days that followed, the two others, frightened, doubtful, restless, or some mixture of the three, also left the property, leaving only Marlene and I. I have, in years since, discovered that these two men, traitors to our enlightened cause, also died by suicide. I do not mourn them, and I rather doubt that Marlene does either. Had they only kept on, they could have shared in our glories, could have seen the dawn break. The two of us remained alone on the property for some 16 months following this final desertion, and it was in this period of closeness that we made the greatest strides in purification. It was early in spring when Marlene informed me that the time had come. The old was set to fall away, and the new would need fresh soil in which to germinate. I was called into the inner sanctum late one night, where I found my former lover blindfolded and seated upon the bed. There, she told me what needed done and what I could expect. I confess that my faith was profoundly shaken by her commands, but meditating upon the task ahead long into the night, I came to accept these orders, just as I had accepted all the rest. I was asked to wait until the presence of the other in her waned, until she was, once again, walking the halls as plain old Marlene. Then, I was to strike a killing blow. The first phase of our lengthy collaboration was to end in Marlene's murder. Only when she had shed her mortal coil could the second phase begin. I never so much as hurt a fly in all my days till the moment I parked the kitchen knife in her guts. The tip landed a few doors down from any organs of note, robbing her of a quick death. She'd been at the sink, tidying up and singing. I recall it was some little jazz ditty, a real Billie Holiday moment. She'd always loved to sing. I held her to me and stroked her hair with the handle jutting from her navel, and I begged her to keep singing till she couldn't take up the breath for another verse. Once she went quiet, I dragged her out into the rain and we went for a swim in the tarn, just as she'd instructed me. In the summer, when the sun is out, you can see straight down to the bottom of the tarn where the perch and bluegill flit about. It's rather shallow, 15 or 20 feet at its deepest, which makes for easy swimming and diving. But there's more than fish and diversion to be found in these clear waters. Its greatest treasures are nigh invisible from the surface and can only be rummaged up by much delving. There are hidden places in the world, places where peace can be heaped upon peace. Nooks and crannies exist in locales of already profound remoteness, and he who discovers one of these can distance and seclude himself to the point of being utterly forgotten by the world, just as slumbering cicadas are forgotten in the years prior to their emergence. Found below the waterline of our soupy tarn are a number of caves, flooded spaces largely unplumbed except by the odd fish. Owing to some geological process, the tarn's banks give way to long, winding passages that lead into the surrounding landscape. There are maybe 5 or 6 of these in total. However, one of them is not like the rest. This singular passage doesn't flood. In fact, it terminates in a dry little cave at the heart of a nearby hill. The tunnel of which I speak is easy to find if one knows where to look. But that, of course, is the trouble with all hidden things. To one who is ignorant of its whereabouts, it may as well not exist. In the plainest terms, then, it was a fine place to hide a body. On the night I killed her, I descended into the cold waters and, with only a boat light to aid me, brought her into the aforementioned tunnel. Inside, surrounded by cool, vaporous air, I left her perched against the far wall, blindfolded, with a kiss on her clammy brow and a promise that I would return in a decade's time. For 10 years, the other would be at work within her remains, taking on a new form. Shielded from the eyes of the world, the veiled sitter would bide its time and mesh its inconceivable mode of existence with the fabric of waking reality. This transition would take 10 long years. As a tropical fish requires careful introduction to a hobbyist's tank, the other required time and silence to ingratiate itself with our plane. What's more, when its binding was through, it would require release from its subterranean tomb. This task, a retrieval from the deeps, was left to me. Presently, I went sloshing into the tarn with my LED. It had been 10 years since I'd last entered these waters, almost to the hour. The time had finally come. The new dawn was set to break. A sharp inhale, a dive, and a leisurely rightward groping were all it took. Mentally, I must have rehearsed the whole sequence a million times over the past 10 years. I discovered the ridged cavern entrance with breath to spare and quickly went wriggling through, LED piercing the darkness of the inner earth. There was a narrowing and a massing of silt upon the surface. I fought through both and dragged myself into the opening, a child stirring in the hillside's lonesome womb. Damp air and damper earth awaited me within. It was almost impossible to breathe the miasmic stuff that crowded in on me, laden with the stench of minerals. I was tunnel-bound now, crawling on all fours without enough room to sit upright. The light was nudged ahead of me every few moments, bringing still more of the cavern into focus while I clambered over soft soils and smooth stones. And then, suddenly, there was no longer any need for progress. I had reached the end. There, huddled in the corner where I'd left her, was Marlene. I admit that my breath hitched in my throat at sighting the tips of her toes, the only part of her then visible on account of the light's position. Skin as dry and dark as leather clung to those toes, an admittedly baffling sight since I'd come in search of newness and vitality. I was slow to advance to shed more light on the figure stashed there, and every salutation I dreamt up went tumbling back down my throat before I could voice it. Still dripping, my hand quaked as I held out the light. Death and spoilage had gripped her feet, her legs. The things remained curled up against her like the brittle limbs of a dead insect left to bake in the sun.
Oh, Veiled One, I finally muttered. Are you there?
The light danced upon her midsection, bringing up a withered waist wrapped in dusty, blood-stained cotton, the dress she died in. The handle of the kitchen knife, still jutting from her belly, cast a long shadow against the wall of the cavern as I drew a little nearer. Her thin arms had been folded around her torso in an eternal self-embrace. The long-standing stiffness of death was upon her. Nowhere could I spy even a glimmer of the promised rebirth. I admit, I was shaken by doubt as I crawled forward and fixed the light upon her face. There, a truly terrible sight awaited me. The blindfold still clung tenuously to a pitted and skeletal face, and sparse hair remained tethered stubbornly to a dead scalp. There was no movement in the veiled eyelids, no color or quiver in the earthworm-like lips, no heave in the still breast. Gravity had eased her mouth open, left her lower jaw to sink by slow degrees till it seemed fixed in an endless yawn. The tongue beyond her pearly teeth had been reduced to a rough and shrunken stub. I sat upon the damp floor of the cavern in disbelief. 10 years. 10 long years I'd waited for this day. I had returned, fully expecting to find something otherworldly awaiting me in the subterranean darkness. Instead, I'd found only a corpse. I was plagued by despair, by regret. Had we miscalculated? Had the sect of the Veiled Sentinel been founded on delusions? Had the others' teachings been false? I began to doubt everything I knew, everything I thought I'd known. For some time, I spiraled in the darkness of the inner earth, lightheaded in the moist, unpalatable air. So distracted was I in my misery that I failed to notice the first stirrings of life in the corpse stationed before me. In the corner of my eye, I happened to catch a hint of movement, the rise and fall of a hardened breast. This was not the rise and subsequent fall of respiration, but indicative, it seemed, of a more central stirring. Something within that breast had repositioned itself, and I watched through tears as it traveled upward, slowly leaving the cadaver's center. The dead neck was inflated by the slow passage of the thing. Something flexed and burgeoned within the leathery confines of the corpse's throat. I wondered if this movement was owed to the writhings of some pest or to a buildup of noxious gas within the cadaver. But when the voice called out to me from beyond her lips, I realized it was neither. "Darling." The words seeped out of Marlene like a sigh. Her throat bulged as if with pent-up wordage, but for a long while she said nothing more. I had begun to doubt what I'd heard when, finally, the voice made a reprise. "Darling, you've returned." I snapped to attention, clutching at the earth with shuddering hands. "Marlene, is that really you?" In the subsequent silence, I grew anxious and fidgeted with the LED. Has the transformation taken place, Master?" "Do you doubt?" came the response. I had begun to doubt, and racked with guilt for my lapse of faith, I said nothing. A phantasmal laugh filled the cavern, Marlene's laugh. The frog-like bulge of Marlene's throat ceased as the unseen obstruction rose up and tumbled into her open mouth. I caught doubtful flickers of movement beyond her lips, but could not, for all my staring, determine what had emerged. "I will prove it to you, my faithful one." There was a moment of perfect quiet. Then, softly, the thing in Marlene's mouth began to sing. My ears perked up at once, and in my excitement, I nearly banged my head against the ceiling of the cavern. The shadowed tunnel was filled with song, a fragment of "When Your Lover Has Gone." Note for note, the old standard was sung as only Marlene could have sung it, and I sat enraptured till finally silence reigned again. "Oh, Master, what do you ask of me?" I bowed obeisance, my brow touching the earth. "Take me from this place," came the breathy reply. How shall I take you?" I asked, sizing up the corpse. "Will the vessel hold if I carry it through the water?" "No," whispered the shying fugitive in her throat. "No. You must protect me from the water. Things are delicate at this hour, my love. I must have air. I must be kept dry. As for this old husk, I have no use of it. It can remain here."
"I don't understand," I said. "How shall I take you to the surface, then? We must swim a little distance to exit the tarn."
"Come closer," ordered the hidden thing. "Come closer, my dear, and press your lips to mine, just as we used to do."
I will not deny my hesitancy at so grotesque an ask.
but I ultimately did as I was told, joining my lips to Marlene's. The leathern texture of the cadaver's open mouth was overwhelmingly repellent to me, and when the corpse's gaseous emissions poured forth from its rotting core and into my own airways, I nearly retched. I was robbed of the chance, however, by a sudden seizing of my tongue. Something dashed out of the corpse's mouth and went bounding into my own, a swift and jagged something, which at once bolted for the end of my throat and hampered the aforementioned wave of sickness like a cork stopper. I felt chitinous legs engaged in a thorough study of my oral terrain, their spindly ends found purchase between my teeth, and the thing's shuddering mass cozied up against my hard palate with a pleased shudder.
"Very good, my darling, very good," came the thing's voice, and when it spoke, pressed against the roof of my mouth as it was, every syllable went rattling through my skull and tickled my brain. "Take a deep breath and keep your mouth closed, just until we're out of the water."
A gush of saliva welled up in my mouth, and I felt the coarse hairs on the thing's back flatten against my tongue like the threads of a wet mop. Breathing around the twitching thing proved difficult, but as I slowly eased my way out of the tunnel, leaving the corpse behind, I made several attempts to fill my lungs. Finally, meeting the waters at the cavern's entrance with my boots, I took a final gasp and then pursed my lips. We went rolling into the tarn, me and the thing that had crawled from my lover's mouth. I kicked hard, fighting toward the surface with my jaw tensed, and within a few moments I found it, planting the LED in the muddy bank. Shuddering, I hauled myself out of the tarn and climbed commando style across the field till I had come again to the ring of boulders beyond.
"Well done," the thing cooed at my uvula as though it were a microphone. "Well done, my dear. The new dawn is soon to break."
I shambled back to the car, teetering between illness and unbridled excitement. The Veiled One had taken on a most unexpected form in its 10 years of development. Where I had planned to find something humanoid and familiar in the cavern, the other had instead opted for a smaller, stranger design. I dropped into the driver's seat, sopping wet, and slammed the door shut. Only then did the thing come bounding out of my mouth. With a hard push of the forelegs, it stroked at my chin, cheeks, and nose before springing quickly toward the dash. I heard a dull, moist thud, followed by a hasty scamper. The thing disappeared beneath the passenger seat without my ever getting a very good look at it. I remained lighthearted and drooling, hands linked through the steering wheel. What now? I asked, unable to swallow for fear of vomiting. The many-legged shadow took to preening itself.
"Take me far from here, darling," it commanded. "Take me to your home."
"Home?" I echoed.
"Yes. Yes, there is much to do. We have preparations to make before the coming dawn."
Within moments, we were on the open road. The thing went scrambling out of my pocket the moment I thrust open the apartment door. It sped down the hall without a word and vanished from sight. I heard its long legs play against the fibers of my tired carpet, heard its carapace thump against the floor, and then nothing. Like a stranger in my own home, I stood in the entryway a little while, passing my keys from one hand to the other. Thus far, our reunion had been anything but smooth. I had been the very picture of devotion to our cause. I had been devoted to the point of murder and had lived out the prior decade in quiet desperation. Years of desire and curiosity had brought me to this day. But having now made the trip into the cavern, I was left with more questions than answers, and a sinking feeling that I was being ignored by the one I'd served and pined after. Though burning with questions, I had not broken the silence of the lengthy drive home. Instead, I'd stewed in it,
allowed it to almost convince me that all had been a mere illusion. The mysterious thing had not given voice to any forbidden truths, had ceased to praise me for my recovery effort, and couldn't even be bothered to make small talk. The other had simply brooded beneath the passenger seat. I, a cabbie, and she, my icy fare. Upon throwing the car into park, there'd come the tugging at my pant leg. With shocking deftness, the thing had come crawling up the back of my seat, ushering its wiry bulk into my damp pocket. Dutifully, I had ferried it past the threshold. And now, locking up and putting on the lights, I felt very much alone in the apartment. There was some peeling off of wet clothing as I advanced through the living room, along with a jab at the thermostat and a rifling through my hair for bits of detritus. As I paced, eventually stationing myself at the end of the hall, I worked up the courage to address my master.
Are you there, O Veiled One?
I posed, shivering as much from the chill I'd caught as from my intense anticipation. But the one-bedroom unit was wrapped in quietude as clinging as cellophane, and I found myself very much alone, even as my question faded from hearing.
Master?
Then, thinking it might respond to a more familiar name, I called out,
Marlene?
No reply. I heard not so much as a skitter as the minutes ticked by. Whatever my disappointment at being ignored, I was unwilling to court doubts about the master's intentions, and reasoned that the journey from the Tarm had been exhausting for her. It was not my place to question the other, to greedily seek the entity's time and attention. She was my master, and I her servant, and it was only befitting of a servant to wait until such time as she had need of me. I showered and changed into clean clothes, and from there I spent the better part of an hour listening from the foot of my bed for signs of movement through the apartment. Still, I heard nothing. The other, wherever she was, had slipped out of hearing. The day's stresses and exertions had taken their toll on me, and with the bedside lamp still on, I confess I fell asleep shortly thereafter. I did not sleep well, nor deeply, but when I awoke several hours later, I couldn't help noting a few strange changes in my environment. The first, and most immediately noticeable, was the fact that the bedside lamp was now off. The knob had been turned while I'd slept, and the bedroom had been plunged into almost total darkness. The next thing I noticed was related to the first. The lights elsewhere in the apartment, in the hallway, living room, and kitchen, remained on just as I'd left them, and by their combined powers, a fair glow pooled upon the bedroom carpet, just beyond the edge of my half-open door. This, as I blinked and sat upright, gave shape to things in the room which would otherwise have remained doused in shadow. I became dimly aware of the closet across from my bed and of the dresser beside it. Glimpsed in darkness, either of these might have invited unease into an already tired mind. I had only to determine that the dresser was not, in fact, a looming predator before my survey of the room continued, and it was then that I chanced an upward glance, my gaze flirting with the metallic outline of a wall vent positioned just above the doorframe. This thing had been glanced at 1,000 times, a fixture in the room undeserving of the least notice. But never before had I spied the outline of a grinning face behind its narrow slits. A face, whiter than milk, seemed to hover in the shadows of the duct. Wide eyes stared across the darkened room. Their stare rested on me as softly as a feather. Just how long I'd been under this delicate surveillance, I couldn't guess. The eyes were lacking in color, almost inhuman in their darkness. But the gentle framing provided by the arched brows and the toothsome smile, coupled with a dusting of freckles from cheek to cheek, jostled my memories with unexpected viciousness, and from the depths, a name made its way to my lips.
Marlene?
I nearly fell out of bed in disbelief. At once, the face was retracted. There was a fit of scurrying and a long, slow creak,
which seemed to spread across the ceiling till, as before, there was only silence. I stood up and put on the bedroom light, approaching the vent in question. Standing on tiptoe, I ran my shaky fingers against the dusty grate, finding its metal partition still warm on account of recent breath.
"Marlene?"
I called, practically bellowing into the grate.
"Please, Master, please speak to me."
She would not speak. I was pointedly, hatefully ignored. All was stillness and quiet for the remainder of the night. Doubts crept in. When more than 24 hours had passed since I'd brought the other home, and she still hadn't addressed me, still hadn't brought me into the loop or shared with me her grand designs, I began to suspect I'd been had. 10 years prior, Marlene had described the other as a wise and all-powerful presence, a keeper of immense knowledge, a thing so aged that it had watched the seasons roll past since their inceptions. This thing I had brought back with me, however, the thing which had come lurching out of Marlene's corpse, did not strike me as anything of that kind. It was callous and cold, a fine imitator of Marlene's voice and affectations, but perhaps unrelated to the work of our sect. It was, quite possibly, little more than a demonic pest, an opportunist. It was possible, and seemed likelier by the minute, that Marlene had made a connection with some otherworldly being during her lifetime. This entity, a spiritual parasite, had wooed us all with its lofty talk of enlightenment, but had in fact been a schemer from the very start. Planning its escape into the world, it had led us in abominable rites for many months, had watched in delight as we had wounded ourselves in want of the farce it had spun, and had ultimately convinced me to murder sweet Marlene. For some time, I sat in silence about the apartment, building up this theory of mine, but it wouldn't be till almost 36 hours after our reunion that I got something like confirmation. From beyond my window, there came a flurry of flashing lights. An ambulance and fire truck, screaming down the road, had gummed up the lot in front of my building, and I watched a handful of first responders hasten from both toward the stairwell. I stepped out of my unit in time to see them march through the door of an apartment on the floor below, where a weeping woman begged them in.
"My husband, please, please, I found him like this. I don't know what's wrong."
It was only through much eavesdropping and by comparing notes with neighbors that I was able to piece together an account of what had happened. The victim, a middle-aged fellow living in apartment 202, had allegedly been drawn out of his unit by a woman singing. Charmed by the sound and curious, he'd left the sofa to investigate and had walked a little through the common hall. The victim eventually made his way back into his apartment, but when he did not appear well. According to his wife, he'd returned somewhat pale and shaken, his t-shirt damp with sweat. When pressed, he'd said nothing about his time in the hall. In fact, using what seemed to be the last of his energy, he'd waved her off angrily and plopped back down onto the sofa. A few hours later, the woman had come out of her room to discover him sprawled across the floor, his face and neck tinged in a necrotic shade of black. Good and dead. A pair of puncture wounds, equally spaced across the back of the neck, were cited with curiosity by the paramedics. But as regarded this strange injury, curiosity would prove the sole yield. Any connection between a presumed insect bite and the man's sudden and horrific end was dismissed out of hand, for it was common knowledge that no species in the area could possibly answer to the impressive bite marks, nor to such profound deadliness. The death caused a small sensation within the apartment block. Neighbors I seldom saw came crawling out of the woodwork in search of gossip. Theories were put forth ranging from the banal to the ludicrous, but none touched upon the truth. The truth was mine alone, for I knew whose singing had lured the man out of his apartment in the first place, and I had my own notion of whose fangs had found their way into the back of the poor sod's neck. The species was an exotic one indeed, a specimen imported from the underworld itself, and I had been its trafficker. Following the man's death, I became certain of a few things. The first was that I had unwittingly loosed something evil upon the world. I had not brought with me some wise and refined being. My trip to the tarn had brought me into contact with nothing short of a pestilent beast. I was not dealing with the other. I couldn't even be sure that such an entity existed. In all our occult dabbling, Marlene and I had cast forth many nets into the ether, and who could say, after all these years, what had been ensnared in them? We had been charmed by it, thoroughly taken in to the point of devoting our lives to it. But in reality, it had been a monster all the while, growing, plotting, developing. The other thing that I became absolutely certain of was that I had to somehow distance myself from the creature. I couldn't allow the link between us to be discovered by the world at large. What's more, the very existence of said link was a sure liability. My knowledge of the thing was sufficient to paint a target on my back. I reasoned that the creature would eventually return to me, not to bring about some rosy new world, but to make of me what she had made of the man in apartment 202. Within a day, I moved out. I took with me only what I could carry in the trunk of my car and holed myself up in a hotel for some weeks before seeking a new apartment in another city. Rooms in the region were in short supply, leading me to peruse newspaper listings and the like. It was through these channels that I came into contact with an elderly gentleman who, on account of his retirement and desire for a bit of extra income, had decided to let one of the rooms in his house. The place was a little out of the way, somewhat outdated and drab, but I found the owner amiable and the price fair. I paid him a few months of advance rent on a handshake, and the name I provided him with was a false one, for obvious reasons. For 3 weeks running, I've had peace in my little upstairs room. Until this afternoon, that is. You see, I've just returned from an errand. The homeowner is gone, has been out on a trip with friends for more than a day now, leaving me alone on the premises. This is why it's been so disquieting to enter a house that feels well occupied. No sooner did I step through the door just minutes ago did I sense a prying gaze upon me, coupled with the undeniable rupture of an atmosphere whose sole mark should have been stillness. It was a simple thing to put this off, to tell myself that I was merely being paranoid. Harder to deny is the strange noise I heard upon absconding to my room just now. I live on the second story, in a windowed room that faces the front lawn. There are no trees encroaching upon the walls of the house, and the day has proven quite windless. Nevertheless, I've heard certain stirrings in and around the building, as of something patiently scratching at the inside of the walls. Old homes like this are sometimes plagued by mice. Funny that I've never heard them up to this moment. And though the grass on the lawn outside is still as glass, I find myself straining to hear the wind, any wind, for what else could possibly be the source of the faint hum I hear issuing from the ceiling near my closet? I draw a little nearer to the closet door and give it a nudge, finding my bags still stuffed within. There's little more to see, save for a slot of wood in the ceiling, which answers for a door into the attic crawl space. Why, the last time I looked at that wooden panel, I'm fairly sure it was firmly in place. Now it's sitting askew. Could I possibly have knocked it aside while stuffing my things into the closet days prior? No, I rather doubt that. Gaps of darkness are visible around the skewed panel, and the humming seeps from this shadow as blood trickles from a wound. There's nothing of groaning timbers in it, nor settling drywall. It's breathy enough to be the wind. But then, the wind doesn't know the melody of "When Your Lover Has Gone."
That was When the Spider in Your Lover's Mouth Has Gone by Ambrose Ibsen. Once upon a time, a young Ambrose Ibsen discovered a collection of ghost stories on his father's bookshelf. He was never the same again. Apart from horror fiction, he enjoys good coffee, brewed strong. Connect with him on his official website, ambroseibsen.com. That's AmbroseIbsen.com. You know, listeners, I'm a simple man. I take my coffee black, enjoy some plain buttered toast, and goddamn if I don't fall for a good story that blends psychological horror with gross fucking bug monsters. It's a rare day that I get to experience all three, so to Ambrose Ibsen, I extend my gratitude. Just to clarify, for the stories, he didn't make me coffee and toast. If you also enjoyed Ambrose's work, you can find collections of his stories over at good old Velux Books, www.veluxbooks.com. Also, feel free to mention in the comments if you'd like us to try to get more of his tales on Horror Hill. Our operators are standing by. That's it for tonight, friends, but be sure to come back next week for more chilling tales. Until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.